very flat out of that we should pursue the China policy and we should quit walking on eggs with regard to Taiwan and so on. There should be a stronger policy with regard to the Congress and trying to assert leadership and so on. It was not a well-structured or coherent discussion.
Right.
But I remember Roger was pretty much on my side. He and I had the same point of view. I don't think I should put in this record that what you did.
And what was Dick's position?
He was being the conciliator.
And then Tom Shoesmith on slower movement?
Well, Tom's basic position, he didn't enunciate it that night very strongly. Maybe he did. I'd heard it before from him. Taiwan is not Chinese, who's kidding who. I don't think he believes there ever is the possibility of reunification.
But I'm confused as to why Taiwan would have even been an object of discussion at that time. I would have thought the two issues would have been how far do we tilt toward China in the Sino-Soviet context, or are we being made the agents of China in Southeast Asia to the detriment of our interest in the region? But
those things came in, not so much the Soviet, but the Indo-Chinese.
Yes, because that was really the.
That may have been
I
the
think that
point.
Would have been the starting point.
Taiwan may well have come in as through the entry of how we treat them can determine where ASEAN feelings go, et cetera, et cetera.
And was the Brown trip discussed? That was
No.
Because that had been scheduled, but.
And then I went with you on the aircraft to, both Sharon and I did, to Haneda. And you leave Tokyo that same day? It was to be a very brief stopover.
Yes, we had a meeting, though, with the Prime Minister.
Right.
Did you go for that dinner?
I did not.
Oh, that, we went by helicopter to the Prime Minister's residence, and it was a magnificent banquet. One of the finest, aesthetically, Japanese meals.
It was
meals.
A luncheon, wasn't it?
Luncheon,
right.
That's right. And the vice president gave a total debriefing of his trip to China. Well, not total. There were a couple of the Brown trip, I don't think, was mentioned, and the other sensitive things that we were about to embark on were not mentioned, but all the rest were covered. Then there was some discussion of bilateral Japanese-American relations, but not much. I guess it was Mondale Mansfield that went with us for that.
Yes, he did. But then you left that same afternoon because
That night
Mike Mansfield gave a dinner in our honor at the residence. Then. Where did the vice president go from Tokyo directly?
Straight back
right
home.
Back to Washington.
One refueling in Anchorage, mm-hmm. and an arrival in Washington.
And how was the reception at that end?
Oh, it was an extremely successful trip. And as seen as such, it had gotten a great deal of television play in the United States. It was the dominant news event, and that is one reason it explained the timing, because he knew the last week in August is a dead week. And we felt that he had reestablished momentum to the China relationship, that a number of things had to be done, the follow-up to the economic package he put together. Big had wanted the date for the Brown trip set while Mondale was there. He was somewhat angry with me for not having put down the date, but I had felt that it would be very easy to set the date once we get back, once we got back, is what I told him, and that I thought we were pressing for too much, that we had really led to a total breakthrough in the nature of our relations with China. And he said, you watch and see that this is going to be a huge bureaucratic fight now in Washington. The Mondale is for the trip, but it'll take 2 months to set the date for it. And he was, of course, correct, although I still think in retrospect that we were correct and that it was not wise just to proceed on a regular pace. I don't think I was present when Vice President Mondale reported on his trip directly to President Carter, but I helped draft the written report. We had all memcons well in order for him as soon as we arrived. And of course, there was that aspect of the trip that had a fallout for me and why I stayed to the time that I did, because then I was in charge of all of that side of things. That was done out of Spig's office.
Well, there isn't any question that they renewed the momentum to the relationship. You could just feel that on our end in Peking and the relationship with the...
I think it is fair to say the legacy of the Mondale trip was the extension, the key legacy as I see it, was the extension of the relationship, consolidating the economic relationship, the extension of it to the security and military spheres.
Right. Question about it.
That, of course, Mondale is not associated with. I got a window into Mondale, and why he is my candidate for president. I'm very much for him. But I got a window into him just on the trip out. He had conflicting discussion between David Aaron, and he heard conflicting discussion between David Aaron and Holbrooke on the American posture in Cambodia. And the president had already approved the talking points, which were that something to the effect that we understood the role, we found the Pol Pot forces totally odious, and we could never support them, but we understood the role that they play. And the whole contention was over that phrase, but we understand the role they play. And Aaron gave one position, and Holbrooke gave the other, that this was, again, odious, that they were barbaric, that we were in effect killing.
That was the genesis of the dinner discussion.
Of course. Well, that's why, of course, it had to be. It had to be.
Okay.
It had to be. Roger was not on the plane going out. I think he was on the plane. I don't know. I don't remember that. He may have gone out separately. But in any case, there was just a huge fight over that on the plane going out. And Dick Holbrooke wanted that out. And eventually Mondale said, I understand what we're doing. I understand what this sentence implies. The discussion is ended. And there is an element of brutality to the American posture on that issue. And it is not one that any person of moral principle can feel totally comfortable with. But the realities of the situation are unpleasant. There are no pleasant choices. And I saw in that a capacity of his to come down and make a very hard decision, and know what he was doing and move on.
Yeah, that was our argument.
Of course it was. That was Dick Hovind. Dick and Roger were, that's why I asked you about Dick, because Dick and Roger were just at each other over at State Department for 4 or 5 months on this issue, and Dick was constantly trying to erode the American posture, because Holbrooke's position at the time, and I heard him say it, was that Vietnam will eventually dominate Cambodia. They have every right to dominate it. We should accept it and move on. And in fact, accept that Vietnam is the dominant power of Southeast Asia. But that's the issue.
So if my memory was right, Roger and I were on the same side.
Oh yes.
I was very much on that. Probably further.
But I can't understand how it got linked into presidential politics, because I have always felt that let's say that a Kennedy is much more likely eventually to accept the Vietnamese domination of the entire Indochina Peninsula than any other Democratic candidate.
Why'd you say that?
Hmm?
Why'd you say that?
Why? Just from his advisors who were around him.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think Kennedy himself, but on the basis of who his advisors are and who he'd bring in with him, be much more inclined to accept that. Now, I'm not sure that's true of Jan Kalitsky, by the way. Jan may be very tough-nosed in the end, but I think most of
them. I never discussed it with Jan.
No, I haven't either.
I don't know how that came about. And it, with regard to our sidebar bit, so then I went down to Yokosuka, back to the naval base. I know that Admiral Foley, who was newly appointed as commander of the base, gave a banquet for us. And then went back to Tokyo to spend overnight with the Mansfields again, and back to Peking. I got back to Peking on Friday, September the 7th. Former British Prime Minister Edward Heath was visiting Peking at the time. And the British ambassador called and asked could I come over for drinks before dinner, that Mr. Heath would like to renew acquaintances. I had met with him in March of 1971 in London, when he was Prime Minister, of course, and the Ford Motor Company in Britain was engaged in a long strike. Henry Ford II had visited the Prime Minister about 3 weeks before my arrival in London in March of 71. To have lunch with the Prime Minister, had emerged from the luncheon and said, "There's nothing wrong with Ford of Britain. What's wrong is with Britain. If Britain doesn't shape up, Ford is shipping out." And so my purpose in London was to attend an international conference of the Auto Council of the International Metalworkers Federation, of which I was the president. And the heads of the two British unions involved in the Ford strike, Jack Jones of the Transport and General Workers and Hugh Scanlon of the Engineering Union, asked, would I accompany them to see the Prime Minister to, as a counterpoint to the Ford thing. So I said yes. And I went into to the meeting, and I was making my little speech about how these, many of these multinational companies are stronger, more powerful than the host governments of the countries in which they operate, and frequently dictate policy, and so on and so forth. And the Prime Minister interrupts me and says, Mr. Woodcock, because he had a wage policy. He says, the reason the Ford Motor Company is on strike is to try to defend the policies of my government. My government. So I sort of shifted the argument. But then, to my great surprise, he said to my colleagues, why don't you do what Mr. Woodcock does? Have 3-year agreements whereby you spell out the wage increases and have cost of living protection. You could have that much stability, we could show our heels to the rest of Europe. It was not for me to say anything, obviously. I wait for my colleagues to say something, and they said nothing. So we left, and we get outside. I said he wouldn't have said that if Henry Ford had not indicated that was possible. They said, oh, there have been indications of this before, but the lads would never stand for it, meeting the rank and file. Well, that's another story, has nothing to do with China.
Huh.
But the former Prime Minister remembered our little visit. So...
How did that strike end up?
Like most long British strikes, they finally made a settlement in which Ken Bannon, our Ford Vice President of the UAW, made a helping hand through Dearborn, taken to the stewards' body, which voted it down by 90-odd%. Then it went to a vote of the rank and file, which accepted it by almost exactly the same 90-odd%. In that connection.
So the stewards are really not represented. Your implication that stewards frequently in English unions are not represented?
They're not. And I went down to Dagenham, which is the big Ford installations, about an hour's drive out of London, to appear on the picket line after this business with the Prime Minister. And I was a hero, of course. And we were riding back on the bus with lots of stewards, and what they call shop conveners, who are sort of chief stewards. And they want to know, you've only got one union in the auto industry in America, that's right. And you have contracts. Yes. How do you negotiate the contracts? Well, we have a rank-and-file committee that sits in on the negotiations and the offices of the union. How do you know when you've got an agreement? Well, that's our business. We're supposed to know can be obtained short of having a strike, short of continuing a strike. You have to weigh what can be gained or is gained against additional sacrifices. Then what do you do with it? Well, then we take it to Ford National Council, in your case. They vote on it. But then we take it to the rank and file. How do they vote? Oh, I said, usually by secret ballot. No, we don't want any secret ballots, they said. We want to know where people stand. And Gunnar Myrdal once said to me, the trouble with Britain is she never lost a war. The trouble with the British labor movement is it never lost a great strike. The result is they are still living with the ancient forms, and they are. He said, in Sweden, on the other hand, it's trade unions were crushed in a general strike in 1910 or 12, somewhere in there. Absolutely destroyed, so they had to rebuild with modern forms. That's why we have an efficient movement and why Britain has what it has. And it's true.
Japan should be thrown in there someplace in that comparison, but yeah.
Well, Japan has modern forms, but with some slight attitude. But we had a very pleasant reunion with Mr. Heath. He said to me, he has a great sense of humor. Well, he said, I have done something you were never able to do. I said, what's that? He said, bring a three-day week. You remember, because of the coal strike, which brought him down, the whole economy was on a three-day week because of the shortage of coal. He said, I brought a three-day week to industry. Can you say that? And it was about this time that the UN had its first presence in China, with the UN UNDP development programs, and Shalong came as director. An American citizen, but having lived in Egypt for many, many, many years. And
what was his ethnic background?
Jewish, I think.
That's what I thought.
But spoke flawless Arabic, so the Arab ambassadors told me. And it was almost as though he had been cast for this role. Then I see on Monday the 10th, which is a week after the vice president left, a briefing from Minnesota businessmen's trade delegation. They didn't stay behind. This must have been
another.
And then Hubei provincial delegation came back from their visit to the U.S. and I went out to the airport to greet them, because they were the first ones to go and to come back. We had an American librarians delegation. It's only a small one, only four participants. They brought in librarians from all over China to meet with them. It was the head of the National, do we have a national library?
Oh, no, I would be a bit surprised.
But the Chinese were so eager to learn modern library techniques. Minnesota trade delegation was still there.
Leonard, we'll pick this up in our next interview. I want to turn just in the aftermath of the Mondale trip to the broader policy sense of the relationship. There are critics of Carter administration China policy, as you know, who argue that we really did go too, perhaps unthinkingly or too far with the Chinese, perhaps not sufficiently cautiously, in pushing into the defense realm. We'll talk more about that and the Brown trip, which is the next big development. But what were your thoughts after the Mondale trip about, A, the balance we were striking with respect to the Soviet Union, and B, what you saw as unfolding in the relationship? Did you see that it had no constraints, or that it would continually be upward? In other words, let me put it one other way. I remember and the question I phrased just one other way, it, I felt with the Mondale trip, we had run out of our roadmap for Sino-American relations. I remember writing a memo for Zbig to that effect. I had, in January of 79, written what I had hoped would be accomplished in Sino-American relations for the rest of our administration. In fact, it had been accomplished by the point of the Mondale trip. The Mondale trip represented the culmination of our dinner with Jiang Wen-jin after
in Seattle.
We laid out all that we wanted to accomplish. We had accomplished it. And so conceptually, what was the future of the relationship in your mind after Mondale?
Well, that really hinges on the Soviet perception. And I think all the way through, I could not understand how the Soviets possibly could be worried about China. How they could possibly be worried about China for decades to come. Although at the same time I knew they were, that it was not a rational thing. But one has to believe that a big power, no matter how emotional and how emotionally irrational, still acts in rational ways on its basic concerns. I also saw China as being a nation much less equipped to defend itself at that point in 1979 than it had been 15 years before, because it had not only stayed still, probably gone backwards with the impact of the Cultural Revolution. And I really believe that it was possible to work with China to strengthen her defense capabilities, but to strengthen her ability to do it, not by selling them arms or giving them arms because they're a huge force. That was impossible to do, had we wanted to do it. And I did not conceive of any circumstances where we would want to do it. So that having an increasing military relationship within sensible limits and constraints to me made all kinds of sense. Didn't bother me at all. And as far as the Chinese were concerned, they knew when I went there I'd been a strong supporter of detente, and I made no bones with them that I thought it made sense for the United States to try, and not only made sense, it was an imperative for world stability for the United States to try and achieve some equilibrium in a military and power sense with the Soviet Union. Hanshu and I had on three or four occasions some rather serious and spirited discussions about where he painted the Soviets, of course, as total and eternal devils. When I see him again, I hope I get the chance to find out if he still sees them in the same way. I doubt if they still do see them in the same way. Jumping ahead just briefly to the Brown visit, you know, I'd come back in December for consultations, but left on the 26th of December before the occupation of Afghanistan, so that when the secretary came, he had a line which was developed after the invasion.
That's correct.
And which was a total surprise to me. But after I understood it, and at first I didn't understand it, the way the formulation was, willing to sell military equipment, I thought that's a mighty hazy line, but
non-lethal, non-lethal.
Well, that wasn't used in the formulation to begin with. But as the discussions unfolded, that became clear. There was a distinction of lethal and non-lethal. What was the name of the vice chief of staff who headed up the military delegation that came to the U.S. prior to Gung Biao's visit? Duo Chiang?
I don't remember.
Anyway, I remember as we were waiting for a meeting to begin, after the second meeting, he said, "Now, as I understand the new American policy, you will sell us the very latest communications equipment, but no arms, so that at least our men will know very quickly when to get out of there." I just had the comfortable feeling that in the days after the Mondale visit, that this was a relationship which was growing on itself and
on its merits.
On its merits, and would continue.
And so that's the, in that sense, then the Taiwan issue does take on an added feature, because if we're involved constructively with the mainland and have begun even to develop a security connection with them, it makes that our stake is so much. If the potential of China is there, it makes all the sense in the world to put more eggs in that basket and recognize Taiwan for what it is.
Exactly. Because that had always been my perspective
right.
with regard to it.
So you were not concerned about bureaucratic constraints or the morass of China or cultural differences between us eventually intruding, or the instability of leadership in Peking? In other words, your basic view is that China offers a basically stable partner with whom the United States can have an extensive and enduring relationship.
Essentially so. I did worry about the bureaucratics on both sides. But at the same time, I didn't worry very much about it because, as you've just pointed out, things had moved so very fast, amazingly well and amazingly fast, that it just strengthened my visceral reaction that here was a natural relationship, not for an alliance, not for a crusade, but a natural relationship of friendly nations that would feed upon itself.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, you asked, I, by the way, my own policy predilection is very similar to yours on this issue, but it's interesting in retrospect, the Mondale trip came back, we came back ready to move ahead.
I think Fritz Mondale has that same feeling.
Yes, I think so too. And in that regard, I think that most of the Democrats, I think Kennedy has probably the same feeling, too. I'm not sure about Gary Hart, but who knows?
Be more cerebral about it.
But in any case, it's worth reflecting that after the Mondale visit, there really was no effort within the administration to develop consensus on China policy. The legacies were there to pursue, but they were pursued through bureaucratic infighting. And there were others in the administration who were very, very cautious or skeptical about the view you have espoused, the view to which I subscribe, and were very nervous that we could become entangled with China and thereby complicate our relations with the Soviet Union, hurt ourselves in Southeast Asia. I suspect that it would have been better if those issues had been addressed in a forthright manner within the administration and settled, instead of have this legacy of
of division, which I think probably still characterizes Democratic Democratic
probably.
Party
I think so.
Policy toward China.
I think so.
There's a and Tsai maybe could have. I don't know whether he could have ever been brought along or not, but he certainly was, from this time on, just a foot dragger.
See, when the times in this period when I saw Tsai Vance, I just saw the sympathetic to China side of Tsai Vance. We did not get into the other aspects. Not that he, I don't mean to indicate he was hiding that from
right.
me, but just the way the conversations went and the ball bounced. I knew about his reservations and his feelings, but not from him in other ways.
Well, you know, I just recollect just the other day when I was at Brookings, I saw Ray Gartoff, who reflects that side of Vance, and I think Vance's views are more complex, but Gartoff said that without hesitation that he believes that normalization cost us salt. But there are a lot of people in who believe that, too.
Well, do they mean that we lost votes in the Senate?
No, that it delayed ratification, that Vance would have had ratification. It cost us a quick conclusion of the salt negotiations. Vance was scheduled to go to Geneva, as you recall, in December.
The week following. Right.
That the announcement that Deng was coming also affronted Brezhnev's dignity, that he did not wish to come at the same time as Deng or in close proximity. And then the issue was put off, finally got back on track, but by such a late date, 79, that ratification became very difficult, and then the Soviets saw us move even further toward China, and Vance has expressed the view that it's possible the move toward China was a major factor causing the Soviets to move into Afghanistan. I'm going to go down and interview him for our oral archives on that point, but I have heard one person removed that is his view.
I find that awfully hard to believe.
Well, I do too.
You see, that Afghanistan, of course, has a border with China, but it's such a tiny border and so inaccessible that it has no military significance.
No, it's just the idea of the Soviets that everything was moving against them, that they were feeling very embattled, isolated, the United States moving toward, very rapidly toward, a very close relationship with their principal adversary.
You know, I tend to accept the idea that the Soviets moved into Afghanistan because here was the third Marxist regime about to topple, but to be replaced by a non-Marxist regime, which on their borders was completely unacceptable. So they did, in accordance with the Brezhnev Doctrine, which long predated China, they moved in.
Right.
I don't think there's any other explanation that I don't accept the Chinese notion that it's all part of their master plan on their march to the Gulf. It's a lot easier ways to get to the Gulf than through Afghanistan.
Right, right.
But I never heard that before.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to pursue it.
I can't see where in the Senate of the United States why the climate on this issue. Scoop Jackson wouldn't have been any different at the beginning of 79 than he was.
Not
the issue.
No, this is talking about the impact that our moving toward China had on the Soviet-American relationship and on Soviet willingness to intervene elsewhere. That's the.
Well, you mean, in addition to Afghanistan, in Africa, for example.
Well, I don't know.
They didn't do anything in Africa after the China thing. They did all those things before.
That's right. But I'm just giving you
Eritrea, Ethiopia, Angola.
It's just a
Mozambique, they were all before.
Well, I'm representing
I understand. I find that amazing.